February 3rd edition of Warrior Connection. I'm Doug Rocky, and as always, you're going to get all the respect you need from us and everybody else. We're going to ensure that you get it. We're going to help you get the medical care you need by providing you information and resources. And follow us along, because Progressive Radio Network is the network of choice to help the veterans, and we are moving forward. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the winter is going on. And we want to have a call-in tonight, so we're inviting all the veterans to call in tonight. Veterans or family members, the phone number to call again is 888-874-4888. Once more, 888-874-4888. If you've never called in, call in. If you've called in before, please call in again. We're going to continue our discussions. Before we get started with the call-ins, and hopefully everybody will call in, many years ago I had the honor of being a winter operations instructor for the 2nd Battalion, 130th Infantry, 66th Brigade, out of the 4th and 7th Infantry Division. And one thing that we went through at that time, and I think bears repeating again today, is just winter safety and all the stuff that we need to remember. As I've been going about the last week, I've noticed way too many individuals, and especially veterans at the Danville VA Medical Center, coming in not dressed for the temperatures. We were down again, getting very low temperatures last week. Our temperatures going up and down. We're at about 15 degrees right now. We'll be getting down again, staying at that tonight, and then warming up this week. But it's extremely important, ladies and gentlemen, if you're a veteran, because of the neuromuscular problems we have, because of the brain injuries we have, because of the respiratory problems that we have, that you stay very, very warm. And that means wearing proper clothes, pants, shirts, socks, and everything. And when you go out, ladies and gentlemen, please, please wear a good jacket, a parka, have a good pair of gloves on. Important to wear a good pair of boots, because one of the deficiencies we've seen over and over again is the inability for us, because of neurological deficits, to know the temperature differences, and our feet and our hands can start getting cold. And remember, the core body temperature has to maintain everything, so the body itself will deliberately shunt blood away from the hands and the feet and the nose and the ears and everything to keep the core warm if that's there. So by wearing a good heavy parka and proper clothing, and then wearing hats and gloves and proper boots, you can sustain yourself. The other thing when you're traveling, ladies and gentlemen, obviously keep a best thing is a sleeping bag in your car. Have some foods and everything else. Have other ways of communication so that you can keep in contact with everybody. In rural areas, it's very easy to get into very trouble, and especially in low temperatures with wind chills, you can get into trouble real fast. Now, remember, wind chill, what wind chill means is we have an ambient temperature of, say, 15 degrees, and we have a wind chill of, say, zero or below. That's the rate of cooling that your body will experience, exposed skin will experience, as if it was at that lower temperature. It's still going to be 15 degrees, but the rate of cooling that your body goes down to 15 degrees if you've got a zero-degree wind chill or below-zero wind chill is extremely rapidly, and you can get into trouble without knowing it whatsoever. The brain does not recognize the deficiencies once you get cold and everything. And so the stuff that's really important to think about right now, winter safety. Denise, are you there with us?
Yes, I am, and I'm wondering if we have any call-ins. We want to get them started. If there anybody called in, please answer up right now.
Okay, well, we're waiting for call-ins. I know we have a football.
We're competing with the Super Bowl today, but I've got a plan.
You know, one thing I want to
plan, Doug, while we're waiting to see if we have call-ins, I'd like to review this past month's deaths, if you would allow me to.
Well, just, yeah, one second I've got. I did get an email from Kevin Lucy just before I came on, and this is extremely important. And I'd just like to read exactly what Kevin sent me. And Kevin has been on here dealing with the suicide, as an expert in suicide, because his son, you know, was one of those casualties. But the email that I just received from him, and I'm going to read this specifically, with the recent VA study being released, it appears that the VA fought against for years. The statistic of an average of 18 veterans committing suicide a day was true. Now the study states that a veteran commits suicide every 65 minutes as opposed to every 80 minutes in 2010 for a daily average total of 22 veterans. We wonder how many lives are lost through the years that the VA denied and defended themselves against those statistics instead of working with all of us to help save lives. It is time for all of us to work together for the future. And again, that came from Kevin. He is a leader in trying to help and prevent suicides and get proper care and everything. So extraordinarily important. We have to remember individuals are dealing with the ethical and moral crisis of war. They're dealing with the total frustration on trying to get medical care that we keep continuously hearing about. And this does lead into total frustration and the possibility of suicide, as do a lot of the medications. Denise, I know you've been an expert on medications and seen the interactions between medications that can lead to this, correct?
Right. And mentioning that, I'm standing down to fill in the blanks for what's going on the Hill about the psychiatric problems. And I want to mention that there's a couple of things going on. Number one is the focus on those that are needing help and the long waiting times at the VA. And what there is a little action on the Hill, or at least some discussions, about using TRICARE and using TRICARE physicians to also become involved in that. And so I think that's important for us to pay attention. And Congressman Miller said tapping into TRICARE's network of psychologists and psychiatrists would allow many veterans to get care closer to home, particularly those who live in rural communities. He doesn't have an estimated price tag yet, but says that whatever it is, that's part of the cost of war. Boy, that's a new saying up there that we've been saying for years, that this is a cost of war that should be programmed in anytime we go into any type of war or combat situation. But his proposal on expansion would only apply to mental health and using the TRICARE physicians to reach out even further. It's still even a modest increase in spending could make Miller's proposal a tough sell at a time when Congress is focused on cutting the debt and dealing with threats of across-the-board spending. Some of the statistics they put out, which are interesting, nearly 22 million veterans live in the United States. Fewer than half are enrolled in the VA system. It's generally reserved for those who have a disability or illness stemming from the service. And the Iraqi and Afghanistani vets are eligible for VA care during their first 5 years back. Those are critical things to remember as we move forward in talking about different topics. And he says, while we must do everything we can to greatly expand the VA's mental health capabilities, I'm open to exploring options outside of the VA for contracting services with public and private mental health providers, including TRICARE. And that was a quote from Senator Sanders, who is going to be the chair now of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee.
That's good for us.
Yeah, and then there was a comment by another person in this article that says the VA needs to step up on training and on offering internships so that it can hire more of these professional people that understand veterans in the mental health area. And I think those were key things to point out there on the suicide rate and the number of vets that do not go to the VA. Last night I happened to speak to one of my old NCOs that I was over there with. Okay? He's got respiratory problems. He's yet to go into the VA and yet to get on the registry, yet to go and see about going to the War-Related Illness Center. He's right there in San Antonio. I had a good discussion with him late at night. We had some laughs about what we remember and trying to remember names of other people. But what really hit me is here I've been so active, and I've tried to connect with the ones I went and served with, and here's one that hasn't got the word. Get into that VA system. And you've got to get in there. You've got to apply for your claim. We fought and got an extension on the Gulf War illness for our claims, so that it'll carry us through, I think, 2016, 2017. So, and we fought for that extension each time it's come up. So, veterans, if you're out there, you need to avail yourself of the VA system. The numbers I just gave you show that a lot of veterans do not even go to the VA. If they're still employed, they'll use their health care insurance. If they're retired, they'll use their TRICARE. And it's terribly important for all the veterans to get into the VA system, at least get on the GovFlora registry, find out what's going on. I just want to encourage the vets to utilize and get in there, because we can't help them too much if we don't get them in the door.
Now, for those people that are unfamiliar with TRICARE, TRICARE is the medical system for the active duty military and for military retirees and those individuals that have been medically retired from the military. TRICARE can be used at military installations itself, or TRICARE can be used throughout the nation at contractors. A lot of medical people are into the TRICARE network. And if you have the TRICARE, you can just go and your regular physician takes it. You don't have to mess with the VA. You just go to a regular TRICARE physician. The other thing, too, is you combine your VA care, your TRICARE, and also if you have civilian medical insurance, you can combine all those together to get help. So that's extremely important. Do we have any call-ins? Has anybody joined us yet?
Any call-ins, please shout out now.
Okay, another thing that's important I think I want to bring up right now.
We had one more related to stress that I wanted to share that was a recent publication this week. And all of us are having trouble, even after years, GovFlora illness, with sleep problems. There is a new study that was put out in the Journal of Sleep, and it focused on those currently returning. This researcher looked at 725 patients, primarily combat vets, who had trouble sleeping and came to the Madigan Lab for a study in 2010. And they have very big concerns on the sleep problem because it ties in. Sleep problems do tie in to combat-related elements such as post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain. And so this is a study that was just published in the journal Sleep. And as we all know, the Army, you know, trains at weird hours, and that doesn't help set good sleep patterns. But the Army Surgeon General, Patricia Horho, has been hitting hard on this theme about getting adequate sleep even when they're deployed, that it's an element of energy management. Sleep is important as oxygen, food, and water. And so the sleep management is an important thing to consider. And in his study, he found, let me see the statistics here, like I said, he studied 725 patients. That's a pretty good size for a study group, Doug. And what he found is that, I'm trying to get to it, that many of these vets were getting less than the optimal time that you should sleep. And all of our vets, I know you and I and others have had this problem of having adequate sleep without interruption or waking up, sweating, what have you. He found nearly two-thirds of those patients slept 6 hours or fewer. And that's more than double the percentage of civilians who report sleeping fewer than 6 hours.
Now, I think with also sleep problems, and again, we've gone through this, and both Denise and I recommend, if you haven't, you definitely need to get to War Injuries Clinic, either out in the West Coast, up at East Orange or that, because they do a sleep study, and that's part of it. And one of the things that we're finding across all the military veterans, Desert Storm, Vietnam, all the way in, especially in the current ones, is there are definitely respiratory problems, commonly called sleep apnea.
And that's exactly what he looked at. 51% of the patients that he saw out of this large group were diagnosed with obstructive sleep apnea or moderate severe obstructive sleep apnea caused by breathing obstruction. That compared with a control group, but almost 25% were diagnosed with insomnia, a lack of sleep that happens for no reason that he could identify, and that's much higher than the control group that he had. 5% of the patients received a diagnosis of paradoxical insomnia, meaning they had a full night's rest, but felt fatigued as if they were missing sleep. Again, much higher than the control group. More than 58% of patients were diagnosed with a separate service-related illness in addition to their sleep disturbance, the most common being depression, anxiety, PTSD, and traumatic brain.
Hey, Denise, you're going to have to speak up. You're fading out with your volume.
Okay, and 25% of them were taking pain medications, which can affect sleep.
Yeah, that's extremely important. I had a conversation with my therapist, and again, I'm back into direct therapy, physical therapy, and also working with acupuncture and then in the pool. The pain levels, again, can interfere with sleep, and is extremely important, as my therapist reminded me this week, to maintain your level of pain medications as whatever you need, again, whether you're just using, you know, standard, you know, Tylenol or whatever you're doing, or if you've got prescribed meds, be very, very careful, especially in the winter months, that you maintain the pain levels control, because if it gets out of control, you get into a cycle where it's hard to get it back in control, and then it totally disrupts your sleep, and then all of this stuff turns into a cyclic mess. It just gets out of control. So very, very, very important. Physical activity, again, for maintaining pain and maintaining levels. Once you get tired, ladies and gentlemen, you got to get sleep. The other thing, too, what we've noticed, and a problem that affects everything, and Denise, I know I've been on you all a long time. Ladies and gentlemen, you can't smoke, and you sure can't drink. And that's hard to walk away from that if you've been doing it for years and years and years. But all of this has a direct interference on sleep, much less all the other health problems that you have that keep manifesting themselves.
Doug, I have another alert that I want to get out since you live up in Illinois. Senator Tom Harkin is having a veterans roundtable, this week in Knoxville on Thursday, February the 7th. So if there's anybody listening from Iowa that's a Gulf War veteran, I want to encourage you to take advantage when the senators have their roundtables for veterans and bring up your issues of your individual issues plus the issue of Gulf War illness. And that's on February 7th. You can contact Senator Tom Harkin's office about where they're holding it in the time period. I don't have that, I don't think. But he is holding a roundtable in his own state of Iowa, Knoxville, on Thursday, February 7th. So that's a beautiful opportunity for people to connect with their senators and reps when they're in need of having veterans' issues discussed.
Have we got anybody that's called in or joined us yet?
Yes, Doug. My name is Kevin Lucy.
Welcome. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And we're calling in due to the issue of the military and veteran suicide.
Yeah, I got your email, Kevin. Yeah, speak up and tell us what's happening, what needs to be done, where we're at in that whole status, and how can we help the families and the veterans. I mean, you've turned into an expert on this. Please help us. The floor is all yours, Kevin.
From what we understand, a report was released from the VA that back in November 2007, CBS News had done an investigative report and reported that 18 veterans a day were committing suicide from all conflicts. And the VA had disputed that, and they had defended themselves against that number. But it appears that a report was just released last week that not only vindicated that that number was correct, but now in the year of 2010, we're losing 22 veterans to suicide per day. And that gives us tremendous concern. If you remember our son back in 2004, coming back from Iraq in 2003, he suffered with undiagnosed PTSD. The VA refused to even assess him for PTSD, and within 11 months of his return, he finally hung himself in our cellar and committed suicide. And the night before, he shared with a a Vet Center employee that no one cared enough to help. And based on these numbers, I would say that that condition still exists.
What, Kevin, from as a father that's gone through this and had to have everything, please provide our listeners some suggestions or observations on recognition and steps that they can take to help the veterans.
Well, first of all, we think that the Congress needs to be contacted. And what we're hoping is that people will say, enough is enough. I mean, we hear of programs being initiated by the military and by the VA, such as the Buddy Program. We hear about these PR movements. And a lot of the programs that are being developed for those with mild to moderate PTSD. What we're concerned about is that I don't hear of any program development for those with moderate to severe PTSD. Our son, they could not find a bed. So one of the things that we would like to do is for Congress to start addressing the problem even more so. I know they've had hearings, but at these hearings, they invite the generals, the admirals, they'll invite VA officials. But what we think that needs to be done is the families of those where the VA failed, they need to be heard. They need to find out. Congress needs to listen to those families to find out what was wrong. Why did our children or our spouses die? The numbers are totally unacceptable, especially for a nation such as ours. And we cannot in any way condone the efforts. And I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not in the middle of the discussion in Washington, but it just doesn't seem that the efforts are there. We're fighting right now. We're trying to support with two families where their veterans have tried to commit suicide. One is age 24. The other was age 23. And it doesn't seem right. The system does not embrace our veterans. There appears to be hurdle after hurdle for our veterans to get the kind of care that they should be.
The other problem I know when we have discussed this, and you've discussed this on the radio show before, is the coordination between the VA practitioners or the care providers, the veterans, and the family members that are with the veterans all the time. Could you describe what's happening there and, again, give some recommendations on what we need to do for that?
Well, when our son was going through his torment, what was happening is that family wasn't even part of it. What happened is that the family was cut out, and we thought that there was going to be a discharge meeting, for example, before Jeff was going to be discharged from the hospital. And instead, what Jeff did was he called us from a payphone or from a phone and stated to his mother, just pick him up because he was waiting outside the VA. That should not occur. One of the things that we've been advocating is, number one, the whole definition of family needs to be redefined because family structures have changed so much during the 30s. To 40 years when possibly they were written. The second issue is that when they discharged Jeff, they used as rationale a strong support system. So we brought Jeff back just a matter of a couple of days, and yet the VA ignored and basically would not take him in. Now, to be fair to the VA, Jeff knew that he should not say he was homicidal or suicidal, so therefore he was very careful about what he uttered. But the other thing is that when you say that you're discharging a veteran to a strong family support system, don't disregard him. I mean, there needs to be policy changes, especially in light of the HIPAA laws. There need to be policy changes that need to be made in order to give our veterans a fair chance. So, I mean, I think the military families, the veteran families, need to be part of the treatment team. Trying to deal with somebody with PTSD and then letting them return to the community without keeping the family involved, to me, is just ignorant. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done. Having said all that, I know that the VA has made changes. I know that the VA has the suicide prevention hotline. I know that the VA has participated, and I'm sure lives have been saved. But as this new number, stress, I mean, we lose a veteran to suicide. Back in 2007, the study said every 80 minutes. Now we lose a veteran every 65 minutes.
You're dropping off, Kevin. Can you speak up?
Oh, sure. As I was saying, in the reports in the past, in 2007, they stated that we were losing a veteran every 80 minutes. Now this report, just reflecting the year of 2010, we are losing veterans at a rate of every 65 minutes. And that's totally unacceptable. Even the 80 minutes was.
We shouldn't be losing any veterans if we're providing proper care. I think one of the problems, and Denise, both you and I have had to work around the hotline, the VA hotline. We have called the hotline. I've called the hotline before myself personally when I've had a bad day. We've had other individuals that have called the hotline. And the hotline, in the experience I've had, is set up sometime for, you know, direct emergency crisis intervention. I mean, severe crisis intervention, but not dealt with trying to prevent the event getting to a crisis level. Now, Denise, you've had to work, and you and I have both worked through the night where we've, you know, setting up, identifying, finding the veteran who, after they had called the hotline, got turned away, where we had to deploy teams to get to the veteran on time. And again, this comes back from the whole medical, the whole area of coming around. Denise, you've been doing that for so many years. I mean, how many have you handled over the years?
I can't even remember, Doug. One of my thoughts as I listen to you and Kevin discuss this is my thought that, Kevin, your group could have a very active role if you write up suggestions to each VA hospital and take it into the administrator, and it might promote getting a family member, group of family members to start working with that VA individual hospital to identify problems that have occurred and how it might be treated better. And I mean, it's a start in each of the local VAs if you could start that way, because we've already experienced the problems with going to the head. You know, so I think we have to work from the top down and the bottom up. So, you know, my recommendation is with your family members that have lost veterans to suicide, get them involved writing up suggestions. What went wrong with your family situation? What needs to be looked at? So that you can get in, and hopefully they can form a group of family members at each VA to look at the procedures they have, to see what went wrong, what needs to be changed. And like I said, you got to go both directions, top down and bottom up, to make this happen. And so I think we're limiting ourselves when we just deal with the top down approach. We need to really get into VA hospitals. I know Doug's worked on that with Guffor Illness in his hospital. But, you know, there needs to be civilian facilities, get groups of patients and families together and have them kind of as additional counsel to meet every so many months to review, you know, what's happening. And, of course, they protect identity and all that. But it seems to me a good thing for us all to try to do is write up our suggestions, put them into the local VA hospital. That VA hospital administrator may like that idea and say, we're going to try it. What do you think about that, Kevin?
Well, I find it very interesting. I mean, due to the fact that we had such a horrible experience with the VA, and I should say it was a local VA, I've had issues trying to connect with them. But I think now that we have to do things like that. I mean, we all have to work together to try to save the lives of our loved ones, because these aren't only our loved ones, but they're also the nation's wounded warriors. And right now, I don't want to become part of the problem, as we have stated that the VA has become. We want to be part of the solution. So I like that idea, Denise. And thank you very much. I mean, we
put it out to your network and see if we can get something started from the bottom up, and approaching with a written statement of what you'd like to see put in place, mm-hmm. what it could do, and it's worth a try. I mean, we have a very valuable resource with our veterans, and they're committing suicides, and we can't just work from the top down.
I think another thing is extremely important, and again, this comes from my own personal experience and Denise and everything, and Kevin, I know it's from your experience, and this, again, this is us trying to help all the veterans, everybody's listening, this turned into an extremely important show right now, is the education of the VA practitioners or the civilian practitioners, whether they're the psychology or whatever they have or in medical, they don't understand the military culture. They don't necessarily understand the interaction of how the military functions, the relationships of the actual service member, the guy or the girl, to the military and what happens with themselves when they get out of the military or they come back from home. So again, this is coming back down into professional medical education. We have to somehow, and I know I keep working on this, get the practitioner to understand what we're thinking, how we think, what the relationships are, how we feel when we run across the frustrations. Extremely important. The other thing, too, for responses, and Denise and I have done this and we've worked this out, ladies and gentlemen, if you have an individual suicidal or thinking about theirs in a crisis mode, we need to get direct intervention, but what we need is a trained professional. We need medical professional because it's the physiological effect. We also need, we have the psychological effects, and we need the trained professionals. One thing that we've seen, and Denise and I remember we had a crisis mode where we got to intervene, and this was at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. When we had a crisis mode, they were going to dispatch the military police. Well, that automatically turns it into an incredible, incredible crisis. Military police have to be a backup, but you need that trained pastor, that, you know, professionals that can deal and help with the individual and understand everything.
While you're talking about that, I had an idea. You know, we have, when there's a casualty notification, there's teams that go out. You know, different people that go out on those teams, including a chaplain. And I think that there needs to be a team approach at each VA hospital that they will respond, would take some funding for these teams to be formed. But the vets are very hesitant to call the hotline because immediately the police go out.
Correct. And that turns into a nightmare.
Yeah, there needs to be a team that, you know, police might have to be on standby but don't approach unless needed. But I think that there needs to be a team approach, a chaplain, somebody trained in psychiatric, to, you know, deploy to this person's house and sit down and talk to them. Say, hey, come out. Have, you know, if it's good weather, let's sit on the porch and let's talk about this. And, you know, hopefully they can work the individual in and then get them into proficient care. And civilians could be involved in this. Civilians in the community that are healthcare psychiatric workers. So this is another idea that just came at me as we were talking of what is needed. And like I said, a lot of the vets say, we're not going to call the hotline. They just send the police. You know, we don't want to be hauled in by the police. So they'll deny that opportunity to get help through the hotline because of that.
There's two important things. If you live in central Illinois or central Indiana, ladies and gentlemen, We do have it set up. You can call the Ileana VA Medical Center 24 hours a day. Ask for the chaplains, and that's under Chaplain Thomas Mills. They have a team put together to help you via the phone, in person, or whatever they have. Again, this is for Central Illinois, Central Indiana. Chaplain Thomas Mills, that phone number is 1-800-320-8387. Again, for Indiana or Illinois, through the Ileana VA Medical Center, Chaplain Thomas Mills, 1-800-320-8387. If you're out on the East Coast, and again, this is the top dog, and you have a problem, and you can contact the War Injuries Clinic in Washington, D.C. And again, Dr. Catherine Bloser, and the phone number there is 202-745-8000, extension 4647. Again, a resource, this is at the War Injuries Clinic in Washington, D.C. Denise and I both work with them a lot, and we've been out there ourselves. 202-745-8000, extension 4647. So there's two resources, ladies and gentlemen, family members, you know, where you're having problems with the psychological and everything. And I can't overemphasize, I can't stress this enough. The physiological damage and effects from toxic exposures and explosives and traumatic brain injury can manifest it as psychological problems. And this is what a long time ago that the Department of Defense tried to push through up at Walter Reed. Denise, you and I were both there when they tried to push it through. But we have to understand and recognize it's a very complex problem.
Okay, Doug, we're at 5:37, my time. And wanted to see if anybody else had called in, not to cut Kevin short, but we wanted to be sure we get to any call-ins. Any call-ins, please speak up now.
Kevin, okay. You got any more ideas, suggestions? You can continue on. The floor is yours.
Well, thank you. But, you know, I like Denise's idea, and I like what you said, Doug. In regards to a veteran who comes home, Jeffy was a reservist. And one of the things is that instead of staying in his in the military unit, as soon as he got to Pendleton, he was there for about 2 weeks, and then he got to New Haven, Connecticut. And then all of a sudden, he was thrust into the civilian world. And what happened is that we truly, back then, did not understand everything that he was going through. And we were rural, so therefore we're about an hour away from the VA. And I think one of the things that happens is that you think with the parent's heart, and you try to write off if he's having a bad day, as long as he gets a good day in. And then when you find yourself in the throes of the PTSD, but for whatever reason, the family adapts to it. We adapt to the chaos. Looking back now, we see things that now we would have said, oh my God, we can't do this. And I love, I just love the idea about a team of people that would be able to come, somebody speak to the veteran, but also somebody to explain to the family, you are not going crazy. This is not a situation which the veteran is making.
That brings up another point, Kevin, is that the Reserve Guard are active duty when these troops return, and they're supposed to get health exams and some assessment done then, is that these DOD units also need to include the family members.
Denise, you're dropping off in volume again.
Being the spouse, the parents, need to be included in that of having conferences of what the symptoms are, where to turn for help, how to feed into the system. And I think that's also somewhat missing in Reserve Guard and active duty, is no attention paid to bringing the family members in and having them as part of the discussion or educational training to try to do some preventative type work of alerting the families of this is what you may see, this is where you may go for help, resources, a basic understanding, and a contact point back to them if they're still in the service, be it Reserve or Guard, a team there that they can call for help.
The one of the things that's come up, and I've got a brochure behind me, I know the Danville-Illinois VA Medical Center in Danville, Illinois, they cover, again, Illinois and Indiana, central portions of the state, and then the primary above that is the big medical center in Indianapolis. They're putting together what's called a patient-aligned care team, PAC team. And, again, the handout, what I'm reading, it says, patient-aligned care team PAC is each veteran working together with healthcare professionals to plan for the whole person care and lifelong health and wellness. The focus is on partnerships with the veterans, and obviously that has to be totally with the family members, parents, spouses, children, whatever we have, access to care using diverse methods, coordinated care among team members, which seems to be horribly lacking all the way across, and then team-based care with veterans as the center of their PAC. So this is a brochure that they have put out there. Again, I know Paul Sullivan and all of them have worked hard on this. There's a lot of groups that have worked on this, trying to get this across. But again, when the veteran goes in or the family member goes in with the veteran or whatever, they have to be there. I mean, you know, and if the VA or the doctor says, well, I don't want the family member here, wait outside. I mean, you know, we have to speak up and say, sorry, that's not going to work.
Exactly.
I know in your case, Kevin, and I'm sorry, again, I just want to remind people, you've talked about this, I know it's frightening to you. You had all the warnings and the VA doctors didn't give you the warning, didn't tell you what your son was planning.
No, you're correct. What happened was, this was in May of 2004. It was Memorial Day weekend, and when we brought Jeff in, we were hoping that he was going to go in. But, you know, one of the factors that really kept Jeff scared about giving too much information was the fact that he had recently applied to become a Massachusetts state trooper. So therefore, the whole power of stigma, it just really reinforced. And that's what delayed his seeking help. But once we got there, like you said, I was kept out of it. Jeff was interviewed by the psychiatrist. And then we found, after the inspector general was able to get us all his medical records, we discovered that Jeff had shared that evening with the psychiatrist that he had three plans to kill himself, and that he actually purchased a hose, which no one ever told us. And yet, after Jeff had shared all that, 3.5 days later, he was discharged out of the hospital. And again, as I stated, they never diagnosed him. They stated that he was going to have to be sober and drug-free for a period of 3 to 6 months before they would even assess him to find out whether he did have PTSD.
See, that's nonsense, because what we've known, I'm going to go back to my own experience, and Denise, I think you and I have talked about this, and we go back over 40 years now. The drug and alcohol abuse is a primary sign and symptom of PTSD, severe PTSD, or the physiological effects leading to PTSD. Correct, Denise?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's extremely, extremely important. Again, I'm going to put out a request. I mean, Kevin, I'm glad you joined us. I'm glad you emailed right before, you know, we came on the show and I responded back to you. But I'm going to put a call right out now. General Eric Shinseki, if you're listening to us, sir, Colonel John Gingrich, if you're listening to us, sir, or if you can pull this up, or any other members of the VA staff across the nation, please, please, take heed to what the parents are saying. Take heed to what we're asking for. and do something to end this. I mean, the Army Times had a big story, and again, I've got it here, where they said the veteran can't deal with this himself. The veteran can't deal with it. They don't have the resources. But the other thing we're finding out, again, is neither the VA nor the active duty military and the TRICARE system have the resources to handle what's happening. And so we have to figure out, how do we prevent or stop us getting into the situation where we need the medical care to begin with? And then how do we improve the access to resources to resolve the problems that we see? I mean, again, General Shinseki, Colonel Gingrich, other members of the VA, the VA Research Advisory Board, Jim Binns, God bless Jim Binns. I mean, Jim Binns and his staff have done incredible work for us, and they've been advocates for us from the very beginning. Their report has been incredibly good. But it seems that neither the Institute of Medicine, Center for Disease Control, or the VA wants to take heed and do what's necessary to resolve it. I mean, is that your experience, Denise and Kevin, both of you?
Yes. Okay, we're at 5:46. Want to let another chance for any other call in? Anybody that has called in, please say so now. Okay, Doug, I have two quick announcements. February 9th at Hampton Roads Convention Center in Hampton, Virginia. Veterans, active duty members, and their families. And this event is co-sponsored by Norfolk DAV Chapter 21 and the National Organization for Aortic Awareness Foundation. And this is on February the 9th, and they're going to be doing a health exposition for veterans. And the first 100 vets who registered will get a free screening for abdominal aortic aneurysm and other heart-related problems from Norwalk General Hospital. And Representative Robert C. Bobby Scott, their representative, will be there. So anybody paying attention to that, they can call 757-423-7100 to get further information. And I wanted to point that out. That's a valuable service, and the person that kind of got this started had an aortic aneurysm. And we talk about the unexploded ordnance, the IEDs, the traumatic brain. You can have damage to your abdominal area during these blasts. And I think this is a very valuable service that they're offering for the vets up there in Virginia. So I wanted to get that word out there. The other word is on February 4th that the Research Advisory Committee will be having a call-in meeting. And it goes for several hours. But if any Gulf War veterans interested in that information and to connect with it by phone, that's our VA Research Advisory Committee, Gulf War Illness Research. Please email me at dsnurse1@yahoo.com, and I will get you the information of how you can connect by phone. And there will be a public comment time over the phone. So I wanted to get those two announcements out to our audience. I feel like those were important to share.
While we continue on, now, Denise, I'm going to tap you. I mean, you were in the military for many years. You reached the rank of major. You were a flight nurse. You were a frontline triage nurse and everything else. We're having an incredible discussion, and all indications are we're going to see a lot more women in frontline combat roles or those combat MOSs in comparison. I mean, there's no doubt that not only the males with the suicide problems, but the females. From the female perspective, as an Air Force nurse and has been involved in all this for, Jesus, now what, 40 years? How do you see, again, the specific problems for females that they're going to face in combat and the psychological and the physiological stresses on them, and what do we need to do?
Oh, man, I hate to start that. I'd like to table it to another show, Doug.
Could we have that and think about doing that?
I think we need to have that.
Could you get some other experts lined up to help us?
Well, we
you know, Julie and
that, that's for sure, because there is a lot of stresses, but I do think that it's time to open up the field to females. We've had, over 155 female veterans die in Iraq and Afghanistan, We've had females in different fields for years, and in these environments that we get into now, it's not the typical front line.
Yeah. Kevin, do you have any family members, again, where they were a female veteran that's been involved in suicide or trying to prevent any of those that you know of that you could help?
No. We do know of females who have committed suicide in the military, but no, we don't have any personal involvement.
Okay. I've got some resources, Doug, that we can tap into for that show. There's another thing that we need to be alert to is on the Hill in D.C., a lot of changes and a lot of cuts will be happening. And this changed way, the CPI, is, you know, really going to be looked at. And I know Senator Sanders is directly involved with this issue. But for the veterans, let me tell you how this would impact. The typical Social Security recipient, and a lot of our veterans get Social Security disability. Retire at age 65 would get $653 less a year at age 75, $1,139 less at age 85. And the proposed changes that they're looking at on cost of living adjustments also would mean that veterans who start receiving VA disability benefits at age 30 would have their benefits reduced by $1,425 at age 45 and $2,341 at age 55 and $3,231 at age 65. And that's according to the Congressional Budget Office. So I think that's another alert for veterans and family members to be aware of, is that as things move along on the Hill, you've got to stay tuned. You've got to input to your senator and your representative how that will impact your family as a veteran. And that's very important to speak up. And Senator Sanders, again, besides leading the charge on veterans, he's very much into Social Security and protecting those that are at risk of being hurt financially by the changes that are being discussed. So Senator Sanders is a champ up there on the Hill, doing a lot of work, and just trying to keep people very much informed on our show, besides having guests, having call-ins, of things that are hot up in D.C. that you need to pay attention to, you need to feed into, and put your thoughts out there to your senators and your reps.
We're running out of time here. We only got a couple of minutes left in the show. I want to revisit again what we had from last week on the Institute of Medicine study. In the Army Times issue for February, again, that's a brand new one that comes on the newsstands on Monday. Kelly Kennedy, again, on page 3, the story is dealing with current vets and Gulf War illness symptoms. Again, the significance of this, and just to quote a little bit, this may be the first time the symptoms suffered by veterans of the 1991 Gulf War have been linked to the veterans of the current wars, which started again in 2001. So we're seeing the same medical effects there. Number 2, the symptoms. The Institute's report, again, chronic multi-symptom illness. Again, we're looking at everything, fatigue, mood, cognition issues, musculoskeletal problems, gastrointestinal, respiratory, and neurological issues, all the same thing. Again, the causes, there's again debate. DOD and VA are still denying the toxic effect causes, which we've known forever, and the internal reports verify. Treatment care has to be very individualized treatment care, ladies and gentlemen, and again, across all the branches of medicine. And again, I can't emphasize enough, and Kevin, God bless you for all the work you've done. The families have to be involved in the veterans' issues, both the psychological and the physiological in need. And then the next thing is, what's next? Good question on what's going to be next. It depends on how much the VA and DOD want to decide to help the veteran and how much they'll allow the veteran and the family members to get involved. Well, we're at the end of our show, ladies and gentlemen. It's turned into an extremely important show. This will be up on the archives. Kevin, thank you very much. God bless you, and our prayers are always with you.